We are now recording. Hello all. Welcome to the May 5th, 6th, 2020 Hyperledger Quilt Community Call. My name is David Fueling. I'm one of the maintainers of the Quilt Project. I'm joined by my esteemed colleagues, Neil, Noah, and Ian, all from Spring. And we may get one or two more here on the call, but the call is being recorded. And before we jump in, Hyperledger is committed to creating a safe and welcoming community for all. So please take a look at our code of conduct and antitrust policy, or Hyperledger's. That's at hyperledger.org. So, hey guys, let's talk agenda. I don't think we need any introductions because we all know each other. But there have been some tickets worked on in Spring, so we can talk about issues and PRs. We had some interesting discussion, Neil and I did, with other people in the Interledger community around the Stream RFC, so we can chat about that. And is there anything else you guys care to talk about or add to the agenda? Take that as a no. I am editing the notes here on the wiki if anyone's interested. So it's been a while since we've had a call like this, and it's actually been a while since we've done much in Quilt. But there's a bunch of stream, I would say, like technical debt maybe, or question marks or something. So let me edit this page here. I think I guess one thing to highlight is when you set up a stream, the typical way we do this in Quilt is we have the client is send only, so the client cannot receive. The RFC allows for like bidirectional sending receiving, but we didn't implement that yet. I don't think we have a use case just yet for it either, so that makes sense. So when that stream opens, the client sends like our client does what we call a preflight. And so it's basically trying to figure out what the receiver's connection asset details are. And so all the implementations that Neil calls this like the dirty little secret of the implementations, they trigger this connection asset details using the connection new address frame. And so that kind of works, but it's not in the spec. So I pushed a little bit to get that clarified, like what is the right way that somebody should trigger this, these connection asset details. And it triggered this interesting sort of discussion. So some people feel like you should not get connection asset details inside of the stream. You should only get them from some higher layer protocol. So like maybe when you do an SPSP call where you get your destination address and your shared secret, you should get the asset details there. And that kind of made sense to me until I started trying to tweak the language of the RFC to make that happen. And it turns out that because stream is bidirectional, any side of the stream, so either the client or the server, can be a receiver. So in the case where a client needs to be a receiver, probably the server, which is actually now the sender in this case, needs to get connection asset details from the client. And of course, that's not going to happen through SPSP. So given that at least one side of the stream needs to get connection asset details from the other side, it seemed more elegant, I guess, to allow either side to get it. So where that kind of ended, it ended in stalemate. It turns out we're like, in a discussion we had, the consensus in the discussion was like, maybe it's okay to disagree one day if everyone moves to SPSP or open payments or whatever the SPSP replacement is, then it's fine. The RFC is fine because no one will be getting their connection asset details inside of a stream. Conversely, if the future state of the world is the opposite, that people are really needing to get their connection asset details, then maybe we update the RFC then. In the meantime, this was like a problem because the JavaScript implementation wasn't responding correctly to the types of addresses that the Java client was sending to it. And so there was a little bit of a stalemate because, like, if one side kind of did the right thing, one implementation, the other implementation would break. So I think we've resolved that. We're just going to like sort of make all the implementations work together. So I have an RFC up on interledger.org with that proposed, outcome, I guess. There's some clarifications in the RFC. And then just some comments about like what we're going to do in the stream implementations. So I'll pause there. Anyone have any thoughts or questions or anything? If not, I'll move into like what the actual issues in Qwilt are for that.
I was going to ask what was breaking on the JavaScript side, but maybe going over the issues will clarify.
Yeah. So what was breaking is the JavaScript receiver is not really stateless. Maybe that's not important, because what was breaking was that once you send some packets to it, it tries to do a reverse rate probe. So the receiver turns into a sender and starts sending packets to the client. But the client's not routable, and so those start rejecting, and the JavaScript stateful receiver is configured to close the stream if it can't get responses back from the client. So of course our client is not routable. Like you can't send it ILP packets because it's just the client, like in an HTTP configuration.
Right.
The JavaScript receiver was built in a time when BTP was the primary link. BTP is based on a WebSocket. So when a client connects over BTP, it's bidirectional. So like you can basically go both ways. Like either side can prepare packets to the other side. I'd say like in the last year and a half or so, we've moved to ILP over HTTP, which, two servers can do that just fine. It's bidirectional, but like my client in a Java app, for example, that's just connecting to a connector is unidirectional.
Okay.
One interesting thing, so like, I guess this does touch on the issue. So I was like, for a long while, I didn't understand what it meant to put we called it the sender address in our Java library for the stream client. It turns out that the sender address and the operator address are technically different. So the operator address would be like a connector that's initiating a stream. And the sender would be like the account that's like sending on that stream. And so in all of our examples, we were putting the operator address, I'm sorry, we were putting the like sender's account address into that field. But it's not routable in a lot of cases. So like, I renamed it to be the operator address in certain places, and then made that field optional. So now if you specify a sender address, it'll work when the client sends out its connection to address frame. It'll have the sender's account address in there. But if you leave it empty, what it will do is it will fall back to the link, and the link has an operator address as part of its contract. And so it won't send that to the receiver. It will actually send a connection new address frame with an empty address. But then when it like returns and gives you a send money result, it'll have the link ILP address on it. So you kind of have some insight for logging or whatever to know like what was the thing that actually sent that stream.
So how are we communicating the sender's address or the operator address to the receiver so that they can send packets back?
So that would be in a connection new address frame.
Right. But if we're just sending the operator address?
Oh yeah. If there's no sender address, then you don't, you send an empty frame.
Ah, okay.
And that, go ahead.
To his point, why would you send the operator address ever as opposed to your actual account sender address?
You don't. Maybe I misspoke there. So when you call, when you construct a send money request, mm-hmm. you will either say, I have a sender address or I don't.
Okay. I thought you said you were using operator address in there somewhere.
Yeah, that's inside the implementation. So send money request will either have a sender address or it won't. Cool. In the case that it does, that will get sent to the receiver. In the case that it doesn't, nothing gets sent to the receiver. Like a connection new address frame does get sent, but it's empty. But then when the send money result returns, it has the link operator address in there. And it's basically just for logging, essentially.
Oh, okay.
Nobody does anything with it, but it's
so
more
the,
like,
the receiver, there's never the operator address sent to the receiver. It's strictly correct. Okay.
Yeah.
So if you send an empty new address frame, what happens on the JavaScript side? Like do they even try to send packets back if there's no address?
Right now they don't. So this is what complicated sort of like the fix for this, because there's JavaScript software out in the wild. If it encounters an address, then it's going to start to rate probe, and then that will fail because our clients aren't routable. But if it's empty, then it will ignore it. So that's great. The problem is that in the RFC, if you want to be like adhering to the spec, the address in the connection new address frame is not optional. So it's technically illegal to send a connection new address frame with an empty address. But that's the only way to get the JavaScript stream receiver to not do its rate probe. So this is what Neil called the dirty little secret of the stream RFC, is that all of the implementations are doing something that's technically illegal in the spec. I mean, I guess I should be, if I really wanted to legalese my way into this and nitpick it, in Java, it's like an optional empty. So you would be like, well, that's obviously illegal. In the stream RFC, it's just a UTF string, UTF-8 string. And the empty string is like technically illegal UTF-8 string. So like, if you wanted to legalese yourself into it, like nobody's violating the stream RFC. It's just that we've implemented the interledger address in Java to not accept the empty string. And so things fail in Java at the interledger address layer, but everything kind of works in the stream codec ASN layer, if that makes sense. I think like it's ambiguous. Like, so Kincaid, for example, who is maintaining a lot of the JavaScript project, is making some changes. Like, basically the JavaScript receiver already accepts empty address and works. In Quilt, I pushed one change yesterday that just added optional. It changed the field type on the connection new address to be optional interledger address. And interestingly enough, that's backward compatible. Like, none of the builders break because they all kind of work whether you supply it or not. and it encodes and decodes just fine. Like if it's empty, we kind of yield an optional empty interledger address. It's a little bit, I don't know, feels a little bit hacky. But it
does break our connector, right? Like we're going to have to update the connector.
That's another interesting thing. So it can break the connector. All existing implementations fill in the sender address because it's not optional at the moment, like in our deployed code. How to say that? Like today's code in production works, of course. My local copy of Quilt, like the master, will break the connector if I send an empty address. But if I don't send an empty address, then everything kind of works for now. So I guess where I'm going with this is you could imagine deploying this new Quilt into our connector receiver. And I'm not aware of anyone sending connection new address frames with empty addresses. So like it should all work. And then very soon, like we should update the connector to run this newer version of Quilt that like accepts both. Agree? Disagree?
No, I was just pointing out like we need to update the connector because once we start using this, like it's not backwards compatible with the current connector. That is
totally true. That actually led yesterday to that logging problem where the stack trace wasn't getting shown in Kibana. Because what's really happening is you send an empty address and the codec blows up because it can't assemble an interledger address with an empty string. But then it eats, like the stack trace, it turns out it was on a different line. So the only error I was seeing was like can't decrypt packet, which was pretty opaque. I didn't really know what was going wrong. I thought maybe the token had been deleted or something like that. I'm just updating some notes here as we go. I'm curious, am I the only one bothered by the triggering thing? Like the streamer FC doesn't say really how anybody should, how a client should tell its receiver, hey, I need connection asset details. And I get there's like disagreement in the community that like, you know, there's different agendas, I suppose, but I'm curious if any of you have opinions, like is sort of the detente or the consensus, just agree to disagree that I laid out earlier, seem fine? Like this isn't maybe worth the effort to fix since all the implementations sort of do something else?
I mean, I was on that call with where this was discussed, and I thought it was reasonable to put it in the RFC to call out like what the RFC should call out what everybody's doing if you want to achieve interop, not necessarily the, you know, for example, they screwed up in the HTTP spec. They misspelled the word refer with one R instead of two. Mm-hmm. But they didn't like go and leave that out of the RFC or the spec because that's what everybody was doing. So if you want to write an HTTP server, even though they would have really preferred that everybody spell it the right way, like after they realized that they screwed it up, like they left, you know, like it calls out like the undesirable behavior, which is you have to misspell refer. Mm-hmm. But that's because if you want to write a HTTP server or client that is, you know, that is compatible, you have to do it the way everybody's doing it. So I kind of feel like this is the way everybody's doing it. And so the RFC should call it out. Now, if later on there's a way to you know, remove that dirty workaround. If there's a better solution, then, you know, sure, the RFC is updated to say this thing's deprecated, you should do this instead. And then at some point, it's no longer deprecated, it's like unsupported. I think we're on the same page there as far as like it should be in the RFC, just because it's the only way you can do it at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. It reminds me too, like I was kind of pushing back, like, well, how does in the inverted model, how does a client receiver get its connection asset details? And I guess it's kind of the same. I forget what Kincaid, he has some valid arguments, I feel like, but I forget what he exactly said. It was either like they don't need it or they would just come when the connection opens, maybe.
Yeah, I don't remember. I remember agreeing with him that it probably makes sense to negotiate the asset details before you connect, but like you could imagine an SPSP that not only do I do an SPSP call where I get your asset details, but if we really wanted to make it bidirectional, I could tell you mine as well. But that doesn't exist. That would require changing a different RFC for SPSP, and that's kind of, according to the coil guys, that's like deprecated being replaced by open payments. So,
I mean, so it does seem like it should be there, right?
Yeah, no, I agree. I didn't quite understand his like objection. Other than it is like maybe not the way you designed it if you did it from scratch. We discussed way back when we ran into this issue of how do we figure out the other side's denomination. That make more sense if there was like a frame that was like connection asset detail request, and then there was a connection asset detail response frame, so that it's not this weird thing where I send you an empty connection new address and you know to send me back connection asset details.
Yeah,
like it's not an intuitive interaction the way it is right now. But it does seem to be that there needs to be a way to do it. Since that frame does exist, I think your point was, if there is a connection asset details frame, the RFC should tell you under what conditions does that get sent and how do I get it from the other side?
Yeah.
Which it's absent at the moment as far as how do I signal to the other side that I want their connection asset details. So why not just call it out?
Yeah. Well, one thought I had, I sort of abandoned it because I'm not sure it's like valuable, but a thought I had was like, it would be useful to have like normative profiles descriptions. So for example, in the case of like a send-only client, there's a lot from the protocol that just isn't usable, or just you can ignore. Like you probably don't, and if you don't need connection migration, even like the things that need to happen in the protocol are a lot simpler. But the way the spec is written is it's like it specifies like how everything would work, and then it sort of leaves like unspoken some of these like simpler profiles. So for example, yeah, it's cool that we can have a bidirectional stream, but what do you do when you don't have a bidirectional stream? So, all right, kind of moving on to the other pull requests that have gone in recently. I attempted to introduce, so one of my fixes for this for a minute was like, okay, cool. If you get an invalid stream frame in Java, we should just like ignore it and move on. Like, cool. I see that frame is not valid. I'm going to ignore it. I'm going to queue all the other frames though. So I tried to actually implement that, and it turned out That's a bad idea for a few reasons. The biggest of which is I couldn't get the, like, the way ASN works is it has all these leading byte indicators. So, like, for example, you would imagine a stream money frame that's missing a field. In JSON, maybe that would just, like, break the parser and it would be really obvious. But in ASN1, like, if it's missing a byte, then the leading byte indicator might be off. And so the only thing I could basically replicate, I'm trying to make a bunch of different invalid stream frames inside of a packet, was like a byte underflow. Like, it couldn't read bytes that it needed to read because they just weren't there, even though the ASN1 said it should be there. So long story short, I pushed a small PR that was basically like, you know what, if you can't decode a stream frame, even though there's many that you theoretically could decode, like, we should just close the stream or throw the exception, whatever. Because there's really no good way to know if bytes are missing and you get this decode error, like, what bytes are necessarily wrong. I think it's also like a fallout of the way our codecs are designed. Codecs are like nested codecs and codecs. And so what I also observed happening was, like, I was trying to catch exceptions. Like, there's a for loop, for example, where it's trying to parse a frame. And so if you catch an exception out of that for loop, you would imagine, well, I'll move on. But because the codecs seem like they're, you know, sort of well separated, but they're actually not. They're actually all operating on the same input stream. And so it might think it's cool, I skipped the frame that just threw the exception, but it's pretty likely that, like, the input stream is just off now and you're not going to be able to do anything further with it. So, for what that's worth, my PR basically turned into a comment with some unit tests that were like, hey, if there's an exception, like, this stream should close. Cool. I'm looking through the PRs here that have come in recently. Looks like, yeah, Oracle changed its Java build, or its JDK 14 URL, so there was a small PR for that. Yeah, there were also some, I put in some alternative, like, methods for encryption and decryption. Like, it turns out the way that Stream version 1 does encryption decryption is, it's not incorrect, but it's backwards compared to the NIST spec. So I added, like, a way to do it the right way, and then, that's a fallback. So just setting the stage for the future, maybe. Maybe nothing ever happens. Like, I suspect that if we ever have a Stream V2, that could be fixed in there. Okay, so I guess I wanted to turn this over to you a little bit, Neil. Two things are coming to mind. One is, there's a bunch of stream, and maybe we don't know the answer to this yet. We might have to revisit this on another call, but, like, there's a bunch of stream issues in Qwilt. And then there's a bunch of things that Kincaid has been doing on the Rust side. For example, there's some problem with dust, for example, like, if you break a payment up and you're not allocating the dust across the entire stream, you'll end up with, like, potentially this final packet that's too small to, like, make it through the payment path. And so I think he was seeing payment failures because that final dust payment couldn't make it. So he devised a mechanism to, like, spread the dust over all the packets so that somehow you don't have that final very tiny payment. There's other things. Oh, go ahead.
As I say on that one, I don't know how that would work where, unless I plan ahead of time of how I'm going to break out the payment and I don't get any flow control or congestion control that tells me I need to do it smaller, then there's no way that I can know by the end, you know, like it seems like I was thinking about this, that there has to be some notion of like what we currently have, like what's the maximum I can send, and we will cap our packets to that amount based on the congestion controls that come back. But it seems like you need the notion of like a minimum amount, and you can kind of figure that out as a sender saying, I know the other side is doing this asset scale, and I know that you can sort of figure out ahead of time that if they're asset scale 6 and I'm asset scale 9, I shouldn't send anything smaller than one unit in asset scale 6. So if I go from one unit asset scale 6, apply whatever, you know, I have to do like the reverse of the, if there's an FX rate, then I can devise that I need to send at least X amount. Now, that would mean then that, like, I was just planning that if we had to do this, that we add some other, like, I was going to try to change how we do the sender so that there's sort of like a filter chain of, hey, everybody, time to prepare a packet. How much do I need to send? Let's say 10,000. Oh, congestion controller says I can only send 1,000. Or, you know, maybe, so I send 1,000, but then let's say it's the opposite where I only need to send one. Oh, the minimum packet filter says I need to send at least 10.
Yeah.
So I send 10. So there's on one side. So I don't have to like try to like calculate this dust ahead of time and spread it out, because I might screw that up and I might end up like, you know, the packets I thought I could send, it turns out by the end I got congestion that didn't let me send them in the amounts I expected. So now I'm back to the same problem of like, I'm down to, there's always going to be the possibility that my last payment couldn't go through in full. So I need to break it up. And if I don't break it up properly, I could break it up into like 1,000. You know, if I'm trying to send 1,001, because that's because of my dust calculation, it turned out the last payment should be 1,001. But then I get a congestion control that says can't send more than 1,000.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to have to, I can send 1,000 and then one, but that's going to fail on the one. So I could send 1,000 and then 10. Mm-hmm. Or maybe I could try to be fancy and say, I'm trying to send 1,001. I know the minimum is this, the maximum is that. Like, let's try to break this into an even, you know, 500 and, you know, 500, 501.
Or yeah. Whatever. I think, yeah, it seems like at best it would be like a happy path thing. Like, of course, liquidity can always change and, you know, you'll wish you had been able to send the one more drop, one more unit, but it's just not possible because that's too small.
Yeah.
So anyway, but as a happy path optimization, if you can pretty quickly get to like my min and my max, then you should be able to sort of predict approximately how many packets it's going to take and set your dust amount that way. It's not going to be perfect, but it might get you, I don't know. Kincaid has a PR that like we should both take a look at, I suppose, before we get too far. Or maybe if you have this filter mechanism, like it can just be another filter. But yeah, loosely in his PR, there was like the min amount, the max amount, dust. There's some kind of slippage calculation that he was doing. And then there was also... like in our case, if we get certain classes of errors, we just sort of fail, but there are certain temporary errors where we keep going and like our only governor is the timeout. In his implementation, he actually is kind of collecting statistics on the number of failed packets. And he'll like preemptively fail the stream if he encounters like certain numbers of those. So something to consider. I'm not sure that we care, especially like for our connector, we're sort of targeting like shorter streams, like maybe bigger packet amounts. So
yeah.
Yeah, so Neil, I don't know, like, do you want to talk a little bit about durable stream sender and just like sort of what you've been thinking and how that might look?
Yeah, I mean, I spent a better part of yesterday trying to the simple stream sender is no longer, like, we've all made the joke, it's not simple. Part of the problem is there's a lot of things happening that you could, well, one problem is that if you want to, in my case, I want to add new behavior of like, I want to inject that just before you send, or sorry, just after you get a fulfillment, I want to update a stream payment database record to say, this thing was sent, like this is money that you sent. And so there wasn't a clear way in the current simple stream sender to like be like, okay, at this point in the fulfillment, I want to inject this behavior to say, I want to update the stream payment that I'm aggregating to indicate that it was fulfilled. And then there were other things I was thinking that could happen in the future where it may be nice, like just before you send a packet, that you put it in the database saying, I'm about to send, you know, especially because I've been advocating for large packets, saying, when possible, you should send if you could send the payment in one packet, that would be ideal, because then you get like an all or none payment. You don't end up with partial payments. Likewise, it's more performant to send big packets than small packets, because you don't have to send 1,000. You could send like 2 maybe, or 1. But in that world where you're sending like one packet, you may want to put that one packet in the database saying, I'm about to send a packet for $1,000. And if my server dies, I sure probably want to go check on any packets that never, that I put an intention of like, I'm sending this packet out for 1,000. When it comes back, normally you'd expect that packet would be marked as fulfilled, maybe even deleted from that database if you don't care about seeing the history of them. But you should have some mechanism to see, what are packets that I sent out that the server never resolved what happened to? So again, you've got this like, just before you're going to send a packet, I want to inject some behavior to say I want to add a callback or something. So I kind of had this notion that the way the sender should work is there's sort of like a set of prepare filters that say we want to send money. At this point, we don't have to record anything in the database. We just have to figure out, like, what are the rules to say what we can send, and things that go in there, like congestion control limits, how much I can send. We have this notion of like a payment tracker that says we've already got this amount in flight, so we don't want to send more than this because we're going to overpay. There could be another filter saying, based on FX, we don't want to do less or more than this. Or same thing with this like dust thing of like, we know that the receiving side can't accept less than this amount. So, you know, let's have a bunch of filters that basically just figure out what should the payment amount be for this packet I'm about to send. Second set of filters would be like, all right, we're going to go send this packet. And there could be a bunch of checks there to say, I want to go make sure I can store this thing in the database. And if I can't, abort the send. I want to do other things like, trying to remember what else would be in there, but you could imagine that there could be other things you want to do, like log the packet, whatever, before you send. Likewise, there would be a chain of things you want to do after the packet comes back, like on response. You could have those things wouldn't necessarily affect the outcome. It'd just be like a set of callbacks to say, once I get a response back, I can register a callback handler. Say, call me whenever in a fulfillment happens because I want to do something. So that's kind of the way it was going. Then there's the other aspect of the simple stream sender that makes it not simple is this parallelization of packets where we have to have an executor service. We want to be able to send packets in parallel because we initially designed it to start with like really small packets and like ramp up. And so, especially if the other side is throttling the max packet amount, you could imagine sending thousands of packets and not wanting to do them one by one. You want to do them in parallel. So that part seems like you could carve off of like, let's just imagine something that doesn't need to know how the packets are calculated as far as like what to send. It's just, I was calling it the packet bazooka, like just, I'm not going to commit it that way, but it's just like this thing that just shoots off a bunch of packets and like manages when they get back, you know, signaling or notifying the callback hooks and having like a kill switch to say, don't, you know, stop sending packets. Like we're done. Kill the bazooka. No more. Stop firing.
Are you, yeah. Can you clarify that? Are you, you are gonna build the bazooka or?
Well, that's where I was thinking maybe the simplest implementation would be like, what if we said you don't do parallel packetization? Like what if V1 of this thing only did packets in sequence? Which means if you actually have to send a payment as 1,000 packets, it's probably not going to complete unless you have really fast latency and or a long timeout. And you could even imagine that you could actually make that thing work for parallel. Like let's say I'm going to send a $1,000 payment. If all I'm given is a sender that can do single packets at a time, it kind of puts it on me to say, well, I know I can't send 1,000 through this sender because it's going to take too long. I'm going to send 10 payments of $100. And so each of those senders is single threaded, but I'm spawning multiple of those. And so you're pushing it up a level to say, the person that's doing the payment, if they really want to push through like a large payment and they know it's going to take a lot of packets, they break up the payment themselves. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to decide if that's like better or worse than saying, no, I'm going to build this this parallel sender that does packets in parallel and has to deal with, like it would simplify the sender quite a bit because a lot of the complexity is things like, I can't send any more packets right now because there's other packets in flight and I need to keep track of those other packets in flight before I can send more. So there's a lot of state management that's complicated because of that, mm-hmm. where we've had like live locks or deadlocks where because there's all this interconnected state, if for some reason they aren't updated correctly or rolled back correctly, then you get into this thing of where it's like, oh, I forgot to tell the congestion controller that packet failed. Therefore, the congestion controller is still congesting me on these other packets that are happening in parallel. And there's been bugs like that. So it would eliminate a certain class of bugs of like trying to coordinate all of these packets that are coming back in parallel and the congestion that's happening in parallel and trying to like synchronize all this. And then, yeah. So I don't know. I don't know if you have thoughts on that of like good idea, bad idea, or no, we really like having this multi-threaded sender.
Yeah, like so yeah, a couple thoughts. I definitely think we should reduce complexity. So like I don't know. That's like the most compelling thing. You used an analogy yesterday with me called the vending machine analogy, where if you want to buy a soda from a vending machine and it costs $1 and you put a quarter in, the vending machine is just gonna be like, wait for it'll show like, you know, the dollar that you owe will go down to 75 cents, I guess. Dating myself because that's not how vending machines work these days, probably. But when you could put coins in a vending machine, it would do that and it wouldn't necessarily care. Like the vending machine has some higher order thing. And so the parallel here would be like the stream is each quarter, but we, you know, because of the design of the RFC and it's supposed to be like bidirectional and whatever, like multi, I forget the word in the spec, but like we could simplify things and just say, you know what, for our durable sender, it's it's not multi-threaded, it's not bi-directional, cool. And then that higher layer that needs to like figure out, you know, is it finished? Like, should I send more? Is the open payment server.
Yeah.
So in that world, I kind of like where you're going. Like, what's weird about it, and the part that I'm trying, they're not sure like what will happen, is imagine the open payment server is like, all right, I'm trying to pay a dollar to this receiver. And the stream, first stream went in and it was 25 cents. And so I need three more streams. And let's say it, someday it gets fancy and it loads up like four send operations, right? So cool, in your durable sender, I don't know how this will actually compose, but you'll have like four database rows, right? You'll do SPSP four times. So there's a lot of overhead that we technically could optimize out if we just did it in one stream with like, or one connection with four streams or whatever. But like, I think that could still work. I guess I'm just unclear. So the connectors have, they're supposed to have these like link limits, right? So if you imagine in my example, there's four, the open payments server has opened four parallel streams. I think that's just going to manifest at the link layer from like the sender wallet to like the next top connector as just like four packets on the wire, right?
Yeah, I mean, I imagined if somebody were to do this, I mean, it would happen right now, even if you did like two simple stream senders in parallel. Like, mm-hmm. I could do that right now. I could try to send money to you or to Rafiki.
Right.
By creating two simple stream senders. If, you know, if their connector is doing sort of global, what would you call it, congestion and liquidity limits, then you would expect that, just like if I try to download a file in parallel, like if I try to download two movies at the same time, I don't get double the bandwidth. I end up like, they each end up going slower. So like, you definitely see that where I'm not getting around that limit. So if the limit is like, let's call it money per second. Like if the connector, for whatever reason, just won't let me send more than 10 cents per second. Mm-hmm.
That's still going to hold,
yeah. Right? It's this weird world and I don't quite understand. There's this, what do they call that? The free option problem that mm-hmm. I suspect, I kind of don't believe that the packetizing things into small packets actually solves the free option problem. It just makes it into, instead of sending one big packet that I can do a free option on, I have to send 1,000 packets that I can do the free option on. But you know, as long as that's not too costly, which it's not clear that it would be, other than bandwidth, mm-hmm. You know, whether I send you 1,000 packets in parallel and then, you know, if I'm sending them to myself to like game this free option problem, you know, I can make 1% on a big packet, or I can make 1% on a bunch of little packets. Either way, I'm making 1% off of you. So I kind of like feel like the world where you have to do big payments as a bunch of little packets like doesn't exist. I think the little packets are only relevant for like web monetization, where you actually do want to send like small amounts, but not so small that it's like, why would you send 1,000 small payments over a second? Why wouldn't you just send one per second? Like, but anyway, it would paint us into the corner of if it turns out there's a world where big payments get broken into thousands of little packets, then this optimization or this simplification would make it harder to work around that. But I feel like that's actually not how the world should work, and not how it probably would work for most wallets. Mm-hmm. So,
but it's occurring to me, setting aside free option, it's probably a longer discussion, I guess, but the trade-off seems to be, well, there are two trade-offs, right? So let's call it the single-threaded stream sender. Mm-hmm. might be a little slower, I guess, but if we assume big packet payments, like it's probably a wash. There's not much gain if you're sending two packets or three. I think most of our payments actually with Rafiki are 11 packets. I guess probably that would manifest, to be honest, like 11 round trips, probably faster than
11 yeah, that's,
parallel. But if we
that's because we start low. Like the other change I was going to make is start high.
Yes.
Right now, if you send money from Rafiki to us, I watch because now that we have that durable receiver, when I send money from Rafiki to us, it happens usually in one packet.
Sweet. Okay, so there it's the same. So in a one or two packet payment, being multi-threaded in the sender doesn't, it just adds complexity for not much benefit. I think if the open payment server needed to spin up, like let's you could imagine the link from Spring to Rafiki is like max packet amount of 1,000, and we need to send a 10,000 unit like open payments payment. You could imagine maybe the open payment server does 10 streams of 1,000 each, right? Let's just say the only downside of that is it's gonna have to go do SPSP 10 times instead of one time. And I kind of feel like, yes, it's a little bit of a performance trade-off, but it's probably worth it to make the stream sender simpler. And then it's also occurring to me that if you have a really solid single-threaded stream sender, you could theoretically write a wrapper that constructs multiple of those stream senders and does them in parallel. And I think the wild card there is just, are those all in the same stream? If they are, that gets, you know, complicated. If they're in different streams, you could imagine, you know, parallelizing, right? It's 10 SPSP calls and then 10 simple stream senders, but they could all run in parallel. They're just disconnected from each other, right?
Yeah, I mean, it would create on the other side though. I mean, the only reason I didn't really like it, or the main reason I didn't like it, was if you're sort of forced to do this, if this becomes the norm that like most payments have to be broken into multiple payments, it just looks a little janky on the receiving side of now you need this notion of like, this is a payment that actually, you know, in my wallet, if I see that you paid me $100 10 times, I might be like, that's weird. Why did he do it that way? Why didn't he just send me $1,000? So humans, you know, showing this to humans in a way that they sort of understand that, these 10 stream payments were actually the same thing. And we kind of discussed this yesterday, mm-hmm. talking about open payments, that, you know, there may need to be some sort of like correlation ID. Maybe that's what we call it, to say, mm-hmm. I'm sending you a stream payment, but just so you know, I want to attach this correlation ID to it so that on the other side, or when I present this in a wallet, you could sort of roll them up.
Yeah.
The user.
Yeah, it's occurring to me like in my like banking wallet, for example, I can like transfer money between banks, like in the fiat world. And when I do that, it just shows like you transferred $100. It tells me where, but it doesn't say, here are the 9 intermediate payments that occurred, like via all of my banking partners to get your $10 or $100 from like your bank to this other bank. Mm-hmm. So maybe we're like over-indexing on like what the user should see. Like, it does occur to me like the receiver in your example, Neil, like the receiver's admin will probably be like going into the connector or the open payments database and be like, whoa, what's this sender doing? 10 different streams just to pay $100 payment. But the user probably should never know. Like they should just see, I paid $100. Unless we really want to like start trying to educate end users around the mechanics of stream for some reason.
Oh yeah, no, we should not do that. No, I think it's going back to the, you know, most of this, it seems like the momentum or the direction at the moment is we need, like, stream is too low level for, like, end users to understand. Open payment is, like, the higher level application type protocol that takes in things like invoices, subscriptions, or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's just be when we design our open invoice payments, both receipts and sends, that it should be designed in such a way that it knows this discrete payment of $1,000 may have actually happened as like multiple stream payments because mm-hmm. for this reason of like, we need to do them in parallel or oops, we did it and we underpaid slightly. So we needed to send a little bit more.
Cool. Well, thanks for that. I'm excited to see what happens here. I think once we get durable sender, durable receiver, we'll, I think, have a really good foundation for transaction history and open payments and all that stuff kind of moving up the chain or up the stack. So more to come. We're over time. I'm going to end it there. And I have moved the cadence of these calls to be monthly. So we'll do this again in a month. Talk to you guys soon.
Cool.
Later.